we're hoping that this will provide us the kinds of resources that we can go after some of the problems that we're starting to see around the state.
A new federal climate office will open in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 10th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a bid to privatize the Goose Creek State Prison.
I really don't think there's support at this time for going down that trail.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is working on plans to establish a new agency as powerful as the National Weather Service to handle climate change issues. The National Climate Service would have six offices around the country, including one in Alaska. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Restructuring NOAA may sound like an exercise in bureaucratic blandness, but Assistant Administrator Laura Fergioni says it's a big deal.
This reorganization for NOAA's climate service is ideally the biggest change that NOAA has undertook since its inception in 1970.
Fergioni is based in Washington, D.C. now, but she worked in Alaska for 15 years. Here, she saw the effects of climate change firsthand. She says initially, the regional office will just include one position, a director, but she says that's an important first step.
To pull together and have a unified voice on what are the unique challenges and needs within Alaska. So this climate service director will really be able to help in that effort and focus in on our climate needs in Alaska.
The director will be housed in the National Weather Service building in Anchorage, where regional scientist Gary Hufford is eagerly awaiting their arrival. Hufford says the new service should help solve one of the biggest problems with climate science in Alaska, large holes in the observation network.
Across the board, observations on species in the ocean, atmosphere, the beaches, and so forth. There's big gaps that we have in that really understanding what's going on. And if we're truly going to understand climate change, so that we can possibly respond to it in an efficient manner, we've got to have those observations.
He says without observation data, it's hard for scientists to make important connections to help explain the effects of climate change.
I've been doing research up on the North Slope since the mid-60s. And which gives away my age a bit. And one of the things that was exacerbating to me was every once in a while, I just didn't have a sufficient amount of data to make the kind of conclusions I really wanted to think that I could make up there if I had that information. So I think we're going to find that we're going to move forward very quickly.
Hufford also thinks the office can help the state adapt to climate changes that are already affecting communities, especially on the coast.
NOAA is going to put a lot of effort into a new grant program with the coastal communities of Alaska to provide funding for them to work with NOAA and the new climate services to put together adaptation plans for their community.
With more data and more research, the new climate service should be able to make better climate change predictions, like what the Arctic sea ice will look like in 2050. Hufford says another big benefit will be having a one-stop shop for all the climate study data.
What happens is there's a lot of little studies going on here, there, and everywhere, and you always worry about the information that they collected is properly archived and can be there for use for others. And right now, we still don't have that, and that's one of the other steps forward we're looking for positively to occur in the near future as well.
Hufford says this year will be devoted to working out the details on the National Climate Service. He hopes at least part of the service will be up and running by 2011. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti today called for more cooperation between the courts and the legislature to reduce problems in Alaska's society, with particular focus on the issue of recidivism.
Fully 66% of offenders, two-thirds of those incarcerated, now reoffend and return to jail at some point in their lives. This is an astounding number, and one that must motivate all of us to examine what causes so many Alaskans to spend their lives cycling in and out of the criminal justice system.
Carpinetti reported that the criminal justice workforce estimates that if the current rate doesn't improve, the state will have to build one new prison at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars every 10 years just to keep pace with the expected prison population.
Obviously, we must do better. We are trying in several ways.
He said the court system is reviewing recidivism and crime reduction programs funded by the legislature last year. When it is completed, the courts and lawmakers will be able to measure the effectiveness of their efforts.
With solid data about actual outcomes, we can learn which methods work and which methods don't work to reduce recidivism, and perhaps even more importantly, learn how and why. With this information, you can make future policy decisions based on hard evidence.
One program Carpinetti expressed hope in focuses on a convict's first 2 days out of prison. He said that is the most critical time when people need support. The court is sponsoring pre-release sessions to teach prisoners what he calls life skills for reintegrating into society. The speech got a good reception from lawmakers. Senate Judiciary Chair Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, said the Chief Justice opened a door between the two branches of government. And as a former state prosecutor, French said, the comments concerning recidivism got a reaction. He said people are beginning to recognize that there's a downside to tough-on-crime policies.
90% of people who go to jail get out. The point is to use that time and the time when they do get out to try to teach them not to reoffend. It lowers the crime rate and it lowers the cost of imprisonment if we can just slow down the rate at which these individuals reoffend.
Justice Carpinetti said taking the steps necessary for communications between the three branches of state government will bring returns to each of them. The Goose Creek Prison, now under construction in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, won't be completed until 2012, yet some in the State Corrections Department are examining a plan to privatize the facility. On Tuesday, Deputy Corrections Commissioner Dwayne Peebles briefed a State House Finance Subcommittee on the possible benefits of privatizing the prison. Peebles said the briefing came at the direction of last year's legislature.
We're just now kind of coming down to a budget, what we think it's going to cost to run Goose Creek. Look at what we're looking, thinking our costs are going to be, and came to the conclusion that everything else is going to be a fixed cost except personal services line. And in comparing the preliminary state personal services line to what the other private vendors might be paying, and I emphasize the word might if they were operating Goose Creek, the major difference that we noticed was the benefit package.
But the savings could come at a cost to state union employees.
If a private contractor ran the facility, they would be responsible for hiring, training, and paying all the staff.
Peebles says four unions would be affected by privatization, and state union contracts call for a notification of each union if the state is considering going further with the plan. John Duffy, Matsu Borough manager, says he was not at the briefing, although he is in Juneau on borough business.
No, I have not heard that. However, I can respond in terms of our past experiences regarding privatization of prisons. In that regards, when we were working on this project that has resulted in the construction of Goose Creek, and I guess to summarize, you know, what the borough's feelings were at that time is that, you know, the borough was supporting a public prison because we believe that prison facilities are basically a public sector responsibility.
Peebles told legislators that the state could save about $6 million by turning over the prison to a private contractor. He said if the state ran Goose Creek, it would cost about $68 million a year. Peebles said the state would need to get proposals from private prison contractors to more accurately determine cost comparisons. Duffy says based on past discussions, privatization is not a cost saver.
And when we looked at some of the proposals that were out there for a private prison, they didn't seem to be saving much money. In fact, when you started to look at it, at least from our perspective at that time, it would cost more money.
Fairbanks Representative Mike Kelly, who is drafting the corrections budget, is taking a cautious view of the private prison plan.
There might be more interest in that if we were looking at building and operating and looking at the private sector doing the whole thing. This mix and match where we'd build the prison but then others would operate it, I really don't think there's support at this time for going down that trail.
Duffy says depending on any lease agreement, a private prison administrator would have to pay borough taxes on the $240 million facility. Kelly says now that the report has been heard, it is his sense that the committee will drop it. The idea is tinged by earlier plans for private prisons in Whittier, Anchorage, and in other cities that have been proposed but eventually failed because of public opinion against the plans. Private prison plans have also been related to corruption cases, which snared some Alaska legislators. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's cross-country Olympians get settled in Vancouver.
Well, it's a pretty fun sport to be in that the history books are wide open right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The head of the Denali Commission says the agency hopes to fight proposed budget cuts, but will survive if they go through. Federal co-chair Joel Niemeyer says that when he was first chosen to head the Denali Commission last fall, the White House told him it would be rooting out earmarks.
They shared with me that the Obama administration was very interested in scaling back earmarks. So they're following through with what they wanted to do. So what we need to do is the commission and our stakeholders need to develop a strong case statement back to the delegation and Congress and the president that we add value.
The White House budget is only a proposal and needs the approval of Congress. Last year, Alaska's senators were able to push back against some cuts. On the chopping block is all $10 million of the commission's health care facilities construction program, which helps pay for clinics and housing for elders throughout rural Alaska. But Niemeyer says if that does go through, the commission still has funds in the bank to keep the program afloat for a while.
Although the reduction in the annual appropriations is cause for concern, I don't see it as a significant cause of concern. What I want is I want creative Alaskans giving us good ideas that we can then implement and work with.
Niemeyer says plans for this year include renovating a clinic in Wales and building facilities in Vinatai and Chistochina. He says they'll be able to usher a number of projects through their pre-construction phases and help them become attractive to other investors like federal agencies, the state, or private companies.
They can certainly go to other funders to try to fund the balance of the project. And so, as I suggested, maybe the pace of the construction would drop off, but I would expect that a lot of these projects would move forward in time.
In addition to zeroing out funds for the health care facilities construction program, the White House also proposes putting matching requirements on all of the commission's construction projects, a 50% match in hub communities like Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Bethel, and a 20% match for so-called distressed communities. Niemeyer says that's manageable. The White House has proposed holding the commission's base funding at nearly $12 million. In recent years, the commission's overall federal funds have dwindled. He supports efforts by Alaska's senators to create a single standard annual appropriation for the commission, which would take some of the unpredictability out of its funding. Six small mill owners on Prince of Wales Island have formed a biofuels cooperative. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the co-op plans to construct a new plant in Thorne Bay to convert wood waste from area mills into two biofuel products.
The biofuels cooperative includes five small mills in Goose Creek and in Craig. It was formed in August after about 2 years of discussions by a forest products task force on Prince of Wales Island. Keith Landers is a founding member of the cooperative. He owns H&L Salvage Incorporated, a small sawmill in the Goose Creek Industrial Park outside of Thorne Bay. He says a group of mill owners created the cooperative as a means of dealing with wood waste from area mills.
50% of our product that comes from a log is waste. So we have had such a hard time trying to dispose of our waste. Basically, the only way we have to get rid of it is burn it. And wintertime, we have a hard time getting it to burn. Summertime, we have a hard time keeping it in control so it doesn't get out and about and away from us.
Lander says a co-op plans to construct a new plant in Thorne Bay that would produce approximately 10,000 tons of biofuel products.
The co-op has agreed that we are going to produce both a briquette, which is a square presto log, and also we're going to produce a commercial pellet.
The plant would cost about $2.5 million to construct. Lander says the co-op is looking at private financing as well as grants. He says the co-op hopes the regular production of bricks and pellets in Southeast would help further develop a growing market for biofuels in the region.
Right now there's only about 2,400 tons a year of pellets being used in Southeast. But we're hoping that if we build this plant that we can get some of the other industries. We've been contacted by motels. We've been contacted by the school systems. We have a lot of people interested in what we're doing, but the first thing we have to do is bring the product to these people. Right now it costs about $80 a ton just to get pallets from Washington into here. So that's 50% of the cost alone of the pallet added on, bringing them out of Washington.
The proposed plant would bring in an estimated $2 million in revenue annually. Lander says the co-op would like to have the new plant constructed and operating within 2 years. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The Yukon Quest leaders are closing in on Dawson City right now. It looks like Hans Scott will be the first into the checkpoint. According to trail observers, he made a gutsy move between Eagle and Dawson, cutting rest to only 1 or 2 hours to get out in front. The other race leaders, Lance Mackey, Hugh Neff, and Zach Steer, all rested several hours along the 150-mile run from Eagle. The first musher to Dawson wins 4 ounces of gold for being first to the race's halfway point. Steer, who placed second in his only other Quest run in 2004, says the four top teams are closely matched.
No one's going to slow down that I can tell right now. I mean, they're all quality dog teams. They're all quality. All the dogs seem to be in pretty good shape. Good dog drivers.
Hugh Neff, runner-up in last year's Quest, says the lead teams include a lot of experienced dogs.
Basically, it's going to come down to not names of mushers anymore, but you know, how the teams are doing, and that's what it's really all about. And I'm blessed that I've got about half these guys who've done this race a few times, so I'm sure Lance does too, as well as Hans. And I know Zach has John Little's main leader from last year's team, so we all have dogs up front that know where they're going.
The front runners are on record pace. A second group of mushers trailing behind them by several hours includes veterans Ken Anderson, Sonny Lindner, Jerry Willemitzer, and Brent Sass, and rookies Abby West and Josh Cadzo. Willemitzer, who was third in his last Quest in 2007, says he's refocused his race after dropping 3 key dogs.
I have nothing else to worry about than make sure that team looks good. So it takes a lot of pressure off of me, you know. Racing for fifth is not as hard as racing for first.
Veteran Brent Sass of Fairbanks is in a similar situation. He's dropped 5 dogs, all leaders, but remains upbeat.
The race plan is way different than it was when I started. But that's why this is so much fun. Like I'm looking forward to it, and you know it's a bit of survival at this point with only 9 dogs and 650 miles left in the race. It's, you know, I got to make sure I take care of my dogs, and if I do that, I will have a great finish.
Rookie Abby West is down to 10 dogs, but isn't giving up either.
I'm just running my team, and that's it. If I place well, I place well. If not, I'm still going to finish.
While there has been some dog attrition in this year's race, the entire Musher field is intact. All 24 teams that started in Fairbanks Saturday are still on the trail.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2010 BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms for teachers are available in local newspapers and at bpteachers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Alaska's three representatives on the U.S. Olympic cross-country ski team are getting a chance to preview the official course in Whistler for the first time today. They also participated in the first U.S. Nordic Ski press conference at the Games with eight teammates from across the country. Keegan Randall talked about something that was on everyone's mind, the chance to win a medal in the sport for the first time since Bill Koch did in 1976.
Well, it's a pretty fun sport to be in that the history books are wide open right now, and I'm super excited to be on a team that has a ton of momentum. We've put together as a team the best results ever in U.S. skiing history, I think, over the last few years, and the team atmosphere we had in Liebrich at the World Championships last year really contributed to my success and our success as a team, and I think we want to just take that momentum and carry it into these Olympics.
First-time Olympian Holly Brooks is clearly enjoying the experience. Yesterday, she and her teammates had a chance to model their new Olympic-issued wardrobe. The old-fashioned-looking clothes are designed by Ralph Lauren and make the athletes look like they're North Pole explorers in the 1920s. The outfits include things like chunky sweaters, down parkas, white stretchy pants, and clunky mountaineering boots. Fashion aside, Brooks proved last weekend she's a serious contender at these games. Last weekend, she placed as high as 24th in her first World Cup races.
You know, I'm definitely in a unique position in that kind of a rookie to this with having my first World Cup last week. But I had a great time. I'm really glad to have at least two World Cup races under my belt a week before going into the Olympics. And I think it was a real confidence booster. You know, to go out there and race with all the other women and see that I could compete with them and kind of get to know the system and the pace and stuff like that. So it was a real confidence booster, and I was really glad to have that opportunity.
This is Anchorage skier James Southam's second Olympics. He was disappointed in his performance in Torino in 2006, but he's confident in his preparation this time around. Southam is focused on the longer distance races.
In the last year, I've started to focus a lot more on the longer distance races, which are something that I think I just never trained for before. And since I've started doing that, things have come along quite well. And you know, my coach and I put together a good plan, and you know, we've got an amazing group of coaches and WAC staff here at the games that I think are going to give us definitely a big advantage with all the time they spent here.
The first cross-country ski events are scheduled for Monday, February 15th, with the women's 10-kilometer skate and the men's 15-kilometer skate. An effort to create year-round access to Juneau's Blackerby Ridge got some much-needed support Monday. The City Lands Committee approved conceptual design for a trail that would start at the city-owned gravel pit next to Home Depot, travel over city and state land, and end on U.S. Forest Service property above Lemon Creek. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
The Juneau Snowmobile Club has been seeking new trails for a number of years now. In 2007, the Eagle Crest Board denied the group's request to use part of the ski area after a public outcry. But that effort led to the formation of an alpine working group, snowmobilers and backcountry skiers who started looking for other areas people could get into the mountains surrounding Juneau. Ray Howard is a member of the working group and past president of the Snowmobile Club. He says Blackerby Ridge was one of the first areas they identified.
So what this proposal would do would be to put a parking lot kind of off beside Costco and Home Depot, kind of in that big gravel pit there. and we would put a trail structure up into the alpine area. And it'd be a nice through the trees kind of trail, you know, a lot easier access for the summertime users, and then some brand new access for those in the winter.
Howard says other snowmobile trails in the area have become more crowded as the number of snowmobilers has increased.
We've actually seen some folks that you know, are just dedicated backcountry skiers and boarders are finding that rather than waiting in line with a ski pass, that they can find a place to get out there on their own.
The proposed Blackerby Ridge Trail crosses city, state, and federal land, so the project still needs permission from all three governments. Howard says the state and feds already allow snowmobiles, so the only issue should be getting the machines up the hill. That's where the city of Juneau comes in. CBJ Lands manager Heather Marlowe says the big concern was using the gravel pit, which the city plans to subdivide and develop. But since there's already a trailhead at the pit, Marlowe says it should work out.
The Home Depot project developed a trailhead for the Lemon Creek Trail that goes back up into the Lemon Creek drainage. And so what the Alpine group is looking at doing is either overlying that initial section of U.S. Forest Service trail or creating a parallel trail for the first few hundred feet of elevation and then breaking off and continuing up to higher elevation.
Other concerns include avalanche and safety dangers, and it's likely wildlife managers will have to make sure the plan doesn't threaten mountain goat habitat. Howard believes the Alpine Working Group has addressed those issues.
Mountain goat habitat will be mitigated by the fact that you know, goats in the winter, they get kind of down low into the creek bottoms and the real ledgy areas, which would be a place that we wouldn't be around. Certainly safety is probably one of the most significant concerns, and it's really the same as everything else around Juneau, I think, trying to educate the users and just keep folks abreast of you know, what the possibilities are, and that if you go out there, then definitely exposing yourself to some risk.
The CBJ Parks and Recreation Advisory Committee supported the concept in December. With support from the Lands Committee, Howard says the working group is now ready to hire someone to manage it. He's hoping trail mix is available and says snowmobile club members would be willing to offer free labor. Howard estimates the project will cost about $300,000. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.